Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Heretics Hour on Monday, July 7th, 2014. Now, I noticed that as written in numbers only, it's 7714, or as I see it, 7 plus 7 equals 14. I like it when the numbers work out in a kind of a nifty way like that. Doesn't happen very often. So I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host, as always, and I have an interesting show for you tonight. At least I find it so, and I hope that you will too. But first I want to thank a contributor, and that is Jaime from Sunnyside, New York. Doesn't that sound nice, that Sunnyside? And this is the first time I recall receiving anything from Sunnyside. He writes, thank you for your amazing work, and please do not stop. Keep up the good work, with the smile sign after that. Now that buoys me up, right? I think that's that was a very nice message from Jaime. And so if you're listening, Jaime, or when you do listen, I hope you enjoy tonight's topic. I also heard from Jim Hardpecka this past week, who I talked about on last week's show. And Jim wrote to me saying, Carolyn, I heard your podcast on Monday where you questioned the existence of the Fourth Reich. Excuse me. I firmly believe that Hitler, Eva Braun, and Martin Bormann escaped from Berlin and went to Argentina or Antarctica. Now, see, he says he firmly believes it. That's the problem there. He doesn't say I find the evidence compelling or anything like that. He just wants to believe it. But he goes on to say, I don't see how you can criticize me for saying that there is a spiritual dimension to race. Have you never read Evola? Well, that was all he wrote. I didn't cut anything out of it. But I'm reading this tonight because I want to tell you that and tell Jim that I'm going to talk about Evola on my show on Saturday coming up July 12th. I should be doing Saturday shows pretty regularly for a while. And we'll be having one this coming Saturday. And yes, I have read Evola, but I'll save that for Saturday and what I have to say about all that. So then continuing on, another thing some more information that I got before tonight's show was in Ingrid Zundel's power letter that I get every month. And I never find anything in it that that I think is worth sending a letter out for on. I often say, why did I even open this? And why do I bother to read it? And this time, I got it while I was from my mailbox while I was in my car, and I thought I should just put this in my recycling box in the back floor rather than take it in the house. But somehow I couldn't do that, and I brought it in the house, and then I even opened it, and then I even took it to read in the bedroom, and I was so glad I did, because there I found something for the first time in a long time that was really useful. So you never know when something good is going to come up for you from this material. And this was something that her husband Ernst Zundel wrote and sent to her, and she obviously translated it and posted it in her letter. And I found it very useful, and I was glad to read it. And it was about, she had posted an article by Paul Craig Roberts on that had to do with World War II. I didn't read that entire article, but she sent it to Ernst, and Ernst commented on it, wrote back to her with this comment. And I liked Ernst's comment. He said about this, the war within that war, meaning the war within World War II, the war of enormously harmful intrigues caused by large German traitors and German-born saboteurs, with the tribal agenda hidden from view and not mentioned in current official histories, is what caused Germany to lose the war. They are who caused Germany to lose the war. So I notice he says, I think he should be large numbers of German traitors and German-born saboteurs, meaning that they were born in Germany, but they were not German. and therefore they had German citizenship without having German blood. But he goes on to say, but not just individual battles like the Moscow Offensive, Stalingrad, Kursk, etc., but due to widespread treason by German-speaking traitors who hated the Hitler regime for all kinds of reasons of their own. Again, he says German-speaking, meaning those who, many of whom were not German or fully German, but they were, they lived in Germany and spoke German. So he says the Allies succeed in Normandy. You know, that it should be success. I may have typed that wrong. The Allies' success in Normandy, in North Africa, in Sicily, is entirely due to military and political German treason helping the Allies. The Allies, through their brutal use of massive bombing, destroyed the oil refineries, robbing the German jets from having the fuel needed, destroying war production plants, destroying the transportation system, railroads, etc. Because of Lend-Lease, the Soviets had oil reserves the Germans never had. Well, this is not exactly about the traitors here at the end. It's about the reasons why Germany lost the war, not really through any failing of the Germans in their war effort, but simply because of the tactics that were used by the Allies. And I do believe that these, seen through what Ernst has written here, it's like the Allies certainly had this planned out early on, in my opinion, long before the war started, how they were going to completely destroy Germany this time, and they would use any tactics that were necessary. I do think that's probably true. But mostly what I was interested in here was him saying it was the treason that did it. And there are other people who I respect who put who think the burden of why Germany lost the war lies with treason also. So I'm coming myself to this view more and more because it seems as though there's always treason and there's always traitors. But the treason within Germany was greater than we mostly recognize, and so there's a lot of work that can be and should be done in that area. A lot already has, but I think it requires more, and the reasons for it. So that kind of sets the stage here for my show, Traitors and Misfits, which I'm doing another one of, and I'm really liking this this theme trying to get into my place here. I really like this theme, and I'll bet that when Ernst Zundel was talking, was writing this to Ingrid, he wasn't even thinking about Richard Sorge, who I'm going to be talking about tonight. He was probably thinking about a lot of others, but not, because there's different kinds of treason, there's different kinds of traitors, and certain traitors are glamorized, many of them are, not just the Sorge type, but many other types are glamorized. I think that it's very easy to see Sorge as a rather glamorous figure because he Well, his own personality was so strong and actually appealing and attractive when you read about him. But spies are kind of, they're made into James Bond figures. Many of them aren't that way at all, but they still have, for some reason, have a very strong commitment to what they're doing. And that's what's really interests me, is why they, what makes a traitor, and what makes them so committed to what they're doing that they advance into dangerous territory, that they take such chances, and their lives have so much anxiety in them. And they're not all courageous looking people. There's not at all. They're sometimes just ordinary looking, and they don't appear to be particularly strong or anything, but somehow they get into it. And that's the interesting question. If there's any ways to see, if there's any things that we can recognize that causes certain people to do this. Probably there isn't, because there's such a variety. You can find similarities. You can find certain things among certain people who have become traitors to their country, but then there's others that are very different. So it's not something you can put across the board. But speaking of Richard Sorge, and I'm going to go into his background in a minute, but speaking of the glamorization of him, in 1954, a West German film director, Veit Harlan, wrote himself and directed a film he called Betrayal of Germany, and he produced it as a romantic drama starring his wife as the love interest, but he didn't call it Betrayal of Germany. In 1954, and he was this Veit was from the National Socialist days, during which time he was a favorite of Joseph Goebbels, and he directed many National Socialist films, including Jud Sus, Jew Sus, Sus meaning sweet, but Sus is a common Jewish name, Jew Sus. He was banned in this film, not him. The film, yet he was still making, he was still functioning, you know, in post-war Germany. He was, his film was banned 2 days after it was released, but after it underwent further editing, he was required to do, it was then shown. So I don't know what the editing was exactly, but you can kind of imagine. So I want to begin, which I've already asked a question, but I was going to begin by asking what makes a traitor. And I already went through that. One thing I'm partial to is one cause of treason that I'm partial to is how well you fit into the society that you find yourself in. But the thing is, there's different kinds of treason, as I have already suggested. And there's so some of the traitors I've talked about so far have a common pattern, but not all of them. Now, I've talked about, I haven't really gotten into as much of a real treason as I am tonight with Richard Sorge. Because before, my first one, I talked about a couple of contemporary people that I've been involved with. And then the second one, I talked about July 20th conspiracy to assassinate Adolf Hitler, and this brought in a whole huge ring of very large. Well, I don't know if you call it huge, but a very large ring of military officers and others, diplomats included, and some others who were all disenchanted with Hitler or never did like him, and were behind all that. What made them such traitors in my eyes is that they collaborated, they tried to collaborate with the enemy, and they gave information to the enemy, they passed information, and they helped, they wanted Germany to lose the war, so they helped give information in some cases, not everybody did this, but to information about battles and military information to the enemy on both fronts. And I thought that Ernst had commented on the Eastern and Western Front. But maybe I got that in there, or maybe I missed copying that down. I don't know. But this took place on both fronts. But that was, you would say, people who were not unpatriotic, who were not traitors to their nation in their minds, but they were traitors. But they were, they loved their nation, they believed in their nation, but they thought that the government, the current rulers, meaning Hitler, was bad for the people, bad for the nation, and that it was their patriotic duty to do something about it and to remove them. However, when they start passing information to the enemy during time of war, that puts a different color on it. But that is one kind of reason, and it can be principled depending on the circumstances. As I said, the aggravating factor is during time of war. But another kind of treason is opposition to your nation by allying with another nation and helping the other nation over your own nation openly. Now, if you openly change your citizenship, like William Joyce did, who came over to Germany and did radio broadcasts to England from Germany, that can be principle too, because you're being open about it. You're saying what you believe in and why, and you're living up to it, following up on it. But if you're doing it secretly, and you're helping another nation while being a citizen and appearing to be loyal to your own nation, then I don't think it is, and that is what I'd call a serious treason. But the worst kind is when you ally with another nation in time of war and try to defeat your own nation while you're remaining ostensibly loyal to your nation. That's high treason. That's what's considered high treason. And an aggravating factor further to that is actively seeking high political positions that will enable you to pass on top secret information while remaining ostensibly loyal. And, you know, I was going to do tonight not only Sorka, but I thought I would managed to do Sorka in 1 hour, and then I would do the Cambridge Five in the second hour. But a couple days before today, I realized that I was doing that same thing, trying to pack a bunch of stuff in and thinking it wouldn't take very long, and I would never get through it all, and I'd have to cut out so much. So I decided to just do Sorka tonight and do that Cambridge Five, which is another very interesting bunch of stories there. On another night. So I have time tonight to go more into Richard Sorkin than I would have. I'm glad I finally saw the light there. So in Richard Sorkin's case, in the first place, he was only half German. His father was German, his mother was Russian, and I always find that interesting, because there's that other case of that young man in the White Rose Society who was a German. I believe he had been born in Russia too, but his mother was Russian, his father German, and then they moved to Germany when he was very young, and he was brought up German, and nobody questioned his loyalty, just as nobody ever questioned Richard Sorka's loyalty. Because he was half Russian, he was born actually in Russia. He was born in the Baku Governorate in the Russian Empire, which is now Azerbaijan. Is that it or is it something else? Anyway, his father worked for the Caucasian Oil Company. He was a mining engineer. He made good money there, and he went there to while they were developing this the oil franchise there. He wrote later from prison, and he was writing his memoirs a little bit. He said, "The one thing that made my life a little different from the average was a strong awareness of the fact that I had been born in the Southern Caucasus and that we had moved to Berlin when I was very small." Well, he was 2 years old, so he had a kind of a vague memory, though. He's a very smart guy. He is very sensitive and intelligent and he's a very intelligent person. And he, therefore, I can understand he would have some memories of that. And whether he built that up later in his life, that he felt that connection so strongly, or whether he really did have that connection always, that he was a little different from the others because of that, the others in Germany, I don't know. But that's the thing that I would point out if I were looking for reasons that why he was likely, he could be likely to become disloyal to Germany is because of that, because of he's only half and half. Now, I started to talk about that fellow in the White Rose Society. He couldn't get over, he seemed to love his Russian mother more than his German part of his family, and he couldn't get over that fact, even though he was brought up and was patriotic. Entered the war. This was World War II for him. For Sergei, it was World War I. But there was a similarity there between the two of them. And in the end, he betrayed Hitler's Germany, and he wanted to move to Russia. And he thought after the war, he would go to Russia and spend the rest of his life there. So he really wasn't a loyal German. Didn't have that feeling for it, and I don't know. Sorge had a lot of seeming patriotism in his youth, but it was just the way that youths are, you know, and the love of adventure and so on. So we'll go on with him. He also thought his parents' household was a little more cosmopolitan than the average bourgeois home in Berlin. He certainly had a more cosmopolitan outlook. I think he had to mean that his parents were more international minded, since his father had worked in different parts of the world and his mother was Russian. So they wouldn't have engaged in treason, at least they never did. So, but his father died pretty young when he was, I think it was before he even joined the army. He was a teenager. And anyway, Richard participated in German nationalist activities in his youth, and he was 19 in October 1914, and right at that time, he joined up, and actually as a student, and he was put in a student battalion of the 3rd Guards Field Artillery, and he served on the Western Front, but he also served on the Eastern Front, and first he was at the Western Front, and he was wounded a couple of times. He was wounded once there, and then he had to go into a hospital for a little while. He recovered. Then I think he was sent to the Eastern Front, and he was wounded again, but he recovered. But it was on the Eastern Front that he was, some places have this wrong, at least I think this is right, that he was wounded a third time, and this time severely with some bad shrapnel attack, and this was in March 1916. And on Wikipedia, it says it cut off three of his fingers, but I didn't read that anywhere else because I did have time to read about quite a bit. But I suppose he did have some part of his fingers cut off, three fingers cut off, but not the whole fingers, probably not, because nobody mentions it. Nobody else mentions it. And he broke, it broke both of his legs. He got some bad wounds in his legs, broke his bones, and from which he then had a lifelong limp. But he received the Iron Cross, a promotion, and eventually a medical discharge after he got out of the hospital. So, and while he was convalescing from all these injuries that he had, he did a lot of reading, and he was finishing up some of his what he needed to finish to get his degrees and so on, finish his schooling. And he was a very good student. I mean, he really got into study. He was he studied a lot, and he took it seriously. He was a serious-minded person, but he also had a good sense of adventure. So with this combination, it led him into studying. The reason that he studied Marxism, and he actually became convinced that that was the right way to go, were several reasons. One was his experience during the war. He found it really, in the beginning it was okay, but after a while he found it really terrible. And he was very much, he became anti-war and a pacifist even. But I don't know if he was aware of that while he was still serving or not until afterwards, but he didn't like it. He lost all the enthusiasm. You know, nationalism was very rampant and everybody was rah-rah-rahing, and they thought in Germany they thought they'd get in there and win that war pretty quickly and it would all be great for Germany and so on. It didn't work out that way. And things became worse and worse in Germany, but partly because of the Marxist underground working, the Marxist influence that was at work in Germany by all the communist elements and so on. That was a big part of it. Plus the British and so on. Whereas the Germans didn't have the goods that they needed. It was a very, very tough time for Germany, and he saw it as all a big loss. Nothing good came of it, and he felt a connection to Marxism through his great uncle, who he always claimed to be his grandfather. This man named Friedrich Adolf Sorge, who was actually an associate of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, and he was a big communist labor leader in the United States after he got in so much trouble in Europe that he, I have to find my little section on this guy. I seem to have lost it. I was passing by it, and no, that's not it. Okay, sorry about this. Okay, it's right here. This German grandfather of his, who was actually his great uncle, he emigrated to the United States, as I said, but that's because he was driven out of quite a few European countries, and he was on the run. Finally, he got on a boat and went to the United States and went to New Jersey, and became a music teacher there. He seemed to be a well-educated, very intelligent man. His And he became a leading labor organizer. I guess I didn't put too many details down here about him. And he corresponded with Karl Marx from the 1860s until Marx died in 1883. Friedrich Engels visited this older Sorge in Hoboken in 1888 after Sorge had retired from politics. Sorge contributed articles to the German Marxist journal, The New Spirit, from in the 1890s, and the thing is, he was a radical socialist, and he was a very important labor leader in the United States. He was he's quite well known, and he was head of quite a number of these organizations, labor organizations. So, you know, with the way I see it, Richard Sorge needed a father figure, and his own father was, you know, like so many fathers, maybe a little bit distant, and he died kind of early. So Sorge, it seems to me that Sorge wanted to belong to something, and he didn't feel that he belonged anymore in with the German spirit, the Germany that he was disapproving of, because he saw it as falling apart and them not having any new and good ideas. And he truly came to believe, and then he was doing all this reading and studying, and he decided he was a Marxist. Claimed that for himself. That was his new thinking. And that he did that because he felt that the world was lost. He so disliked the bourgeois world, thinking that it was just these men. And also he saw he was in a couple of battles that where it appeared that all these young men that he had come to be feel camaraderie with, thousands of men were sent into battles that were foolish and hopeless by these generals. And you know, this was really bad amongst the Russians. If you think of the German generals were bad about wasting all these young men in World War I, the Russians were even worse. And they had more men to waste, but he wouldn't have known that. He just knew what the German generals were doing. And of course, the Russian generals were also throwing away their human beings in World War II too. They were just throwing, forcing unprepared men and women to go rushing up against the German forces in these battles, because they didn't have a better way to go about it, I guess. And they were just being mowed down. You know, it was terrible waste of humanity going on. But he took an exception to this, and he thought there had to be another way, and he really believed that a whole new slate had to be started. He was a true revolutionary by the time, 1920 or so. He thought that you needed to wipe out the old altogether and create a new and peaceful order, and he thought that was possible. He believed all that Marxist stuff, and so he then was recruited. He was going to meetings, he was looking into things and so on. And he was recruited as an agent for Soviet military intelligence. And it's like with this Richard Sorge, as bright as he was, he never changed his mind about any of this. No matter, I don't know how he avoided knowing what how the communists behaved and all the people that they murdered and all of what they did. But he took it that that the old order was so bad and was so in need of being replaced that no matter what they did, I guess that they had to do it in order to get rid of the old. They had to get rid of all those people, all those old reactionaries, and start anew. So he just continued to believe in it, and he seemed to me that he was sincerely convinced about it. And once he became convinced about it, he couldn't. He never changed his mind. He never seemed to have second thoughts or to reconsider or anything like that. That was it. He had made up his mind. That was it. And he thought it was right. So so then he's in Germany, and he's joined by a woman who he meets a couple, a Dr. Kurt Albert Gerlach, who's a wealthy communist and a professor of political science in Kiel, who had been his teacher. And he met his wife, and Gerlach's wife, Christiane Gerlach, and right away they started having an attraction, and they started having an affair, and then Dr. Gerlach was okay with that. And he let his wife spend her time with Richard Sorge. And eventually, in 1921, in May, they got married. And Dr. Gerlach gave them his blessing. It's kind of a funny story. It's it's turned out all along, as it continues on, the communists are so taken up by their politics that their relationships are just aren't of the same nature, you know, because that's just too bourgeois, I guess. But they just they marry, and then they can separate, and they can have affairs, and they can marry somebody else, and or they can just go around and they can just separate and continue having affairs with other people. And they stay friends, they stay associated, there's no bad feelings, it doesn't seem like. And that is very typical in Marxist type, communist type circles. So he married this woman, and this was his first, and actually his first marriage. He later married a Russian woman, but I'm not sure if they were actually married, but it says basically they were married. And then in the end, he had a mistress who's often called his wife, but they weren't married in Japan. So he had a German wife, and then a Russian wife, and then a Japanese so-called wife. And he was always, he had quite a number of affairs in between that, and he was always very attractive to women and always liked women. So that was always a part of his life. But he was doing everything he could to work for the Marxist cause, and he did things like help organize the library of the Institute for Social Research in Frankfurt, which was the Marxist think tank. And you know, it's funny because he was doing all this openly, and the authorities knew about him. And yet later, when he came back to become a journalist, a German journalist, and was working for these German newspapers and getting foreign assignments, and then what was I going to say there? And getting these foreign assignments, and I got another thought, and I pushed that other one out of my mind. The other thought I have now is that being a journalist is the most typical thing that spies do, that traitors do. That is the best way. They're often set up to be journalists when they didn't start out as journalists, because that is the best way to go around the world to get assignments where they can go into other countries and they can have the cover. It's the best cover that there is. And they can meet a lot of people. They can meet people in government that way too. So that's one sign. There's probably an awful lot of people today, a journalist today, who are working for intelligence agencies of one kind or another. They may not all be full-fledged agents, but they would be perhaps doing something and giving some information out that they're being asked for. And some of them are full-fledged agents. And that comes out fairly often, that's true, that, you know, somebody has been discovered. Anyway, in 1924, Sorge and Christiane moved to Moscow. They wanted him to come there, and he officially joined the International Liaison Department of the Comintern, which was an OGPU intelligence gathering body. And he was so dedicated to his work there. He was busy in Moscow now working, and he was so dedicated that his wife Christiane, who really did love him, became too lonely and found that her life was pretty crummy, and she didn't like Moscow anyway. When they went there, he was fine with it. He didn't seem to notice. She said it was just dreary. It was just horrible. And they got to live in a hotel with a lot of other similar kind of people. But the life there was so bad, and the clothing was so boring, and nothing that a Westerner was used to was available, and she didn't like it. But he didn't have a problem at all. And eventually, though, she finally gave up and said she thought she should go back to Europe, go back to Germany. And he agreed that if that's what she wanted to do, he couldn't offer her any more. You know, he couldn't say, well, I'll do this or do that for you. He wasn't going to change any. So she rather unhappily booked her way back, and then she knew when they parted at the train station that it really, then they, you know, said they would see each other again soon, but she knew it was really over, and it was very traumatic for her. But then that's the way it went. She has a lot of interesting things to say about him and about all of that later on, and she was very sympathetic, you see, to the communist cause. But a lot of these people, once they got to Moscow, they weren't too, or they got into Russia, they saw that it wasn't the way they had imagined it to be. Now, in March 1925, Sorge, he went back to Germany. He had a trip back to Germany. Then he went back to Moscow in March 1925, and he took an oath to the Communist Party to the exclusion of all the other countries and parties. So now he was, he had announced to them that he was all theirs, and he was doing everything he could because he was still convinced that this was going to be a better world. And he was more and more anti-war, and he thought it's kind of in a sense like the powers, the Western powers, the fascist powers, the corporate democratic powers were behind war. And if it wasn't for them, there would be no war. And he really believed that the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was for peaceful people of the world, and was for ending, would never bring about a war, was against war too, and things like that. He really believed all that, and obviously a whole lot of other people did. It's kind of hard for me, in my vantage point, and I imagine a lot of you who are even younger and have never, farther away from those days of the early part of the 20th century, to think that people held these Bolsheviks in high esteem, you know, and thought that they were really gonna make a peaceful world. And there again was the idea that there could be a peaceful world. Not only the Democrats had it, or at least they tried to convince. I don't know that they had it, like Woodrow Wilson, and that in World War One they tried to say that we're fighting this war so that we won't have any more war. Everybody was saying there shouldn't be any more war. So war was very unpopular, but nobody was really prepared to end war, and it hasn't been ended, and I don't see that it ever would be or could be ended. You can't legislate things like this in this way, but that's another aspect. I just want to point out that I'm convinced after studying up on Sorge that he was sincere in his beliefs. Hard to imagine now, but he was sincere at the time, and that's why he was so committed to it. He really was a selfless person in that sense, that he was willing to give all of himself for this higher mission that he thought was so important. And later on, it's brought out that his personal relationships, he could sacrifice any person, and he betrayed a whole lot of people, friends who had become friends and thought he was a friend. He betrayed a lot of people, but he felt that obviously that the cause of world peace and anti-fascism, whatever, was more important than individual friendships. So now, armed with all this, he and on his own again, he went to Britain. They sent him to Britain to study the political and economic conditions there. And he was instructed to remain undercover and stay out of politics. So he always had his controllers, and he always had a one particular controller wherever he went. And he was always getting instructions, and he always sent back what he discovered and his ideas and his and this would be something that he would like, because he was good at figuring things out, and so he would send back what he thought was going on and what would be a good idea, how to handle things, particularly later once the war started. But now it is November in 1929, and he returns to Germany, and he's instructed now to join the Nazi Party and not to associate with any left-wing activists, as now he's taken on his new identity big time as a National Socialist and a right-winger, and he should not have anything to do with left-wing activists any longer. And this is where I kind of wonder how he got away with that, because before he had been working in Germany and around there as a leftist. But in any case, he got a job with an agricultural newspaper as cover for his activities. The newspaper was I won't give the name of it, but it was an agricultural newspaper. And he was always very interested in agriculture, or at least he took that up. I guess he was interested in it, but he studied it quite a bit. And he took that up as his cover. He was very cooperative. He wasn't somebody who was just told what to do, and then he did it. He figured he came up with things himself. And that's why I say when he shared with them as much as they told him what to do, and that's probably why he didn't think that he was under such a dictatorial regime, because they appreciated his good ideas and his initiative that he took. And so he made himself into an agricultural expert, and in 1930 he went to Shanghai, and he worked there. They wanted him to go to China because they thought there was going to be, that's where they needed, China was not cooperating with the Soviet Union, and they thought that's where the problem was going to be, and they needed somebody there. So he went there as a German a newspaper man, and he was employed by the Frankfurter Zeitung. Now here we get into these newspapers he's employed with, and it doesn't say anywhere, but I have to think that that all these contacts that any nation in their intelligence services has all around the world, they have to have them, and they're very sophisticated. You know, the Bolsheviks may have been beginners, but they took over from the Tsar, and the Tsar had a very highly developed intelligence operation for Russia, and they were able to take that over and learn from it and so on. So the communists always had a very high class, I mean, very highly thought of, highly competitive intelligence operation all around the world. And there has to be that they had people in all these places so that someone like Sarger could get a job there. I mean, I don't think they would just depend on him convincing these newspapers that he should be hired. Not that he couldn't have, not that he couldn't have gotten a job on his own, but I don't know that they wouldn't have also been there to give him whatever help they could, so that he could get these jobs and that would work right for him. So you, like, from here on, you know, I talked about he needed a family, or he needed someone to look up to. I think so. And he was never alone. He wasn't alone. When you're in the intelligence, you might think of these people as being, you know, out there, you know, in danger and doing their thing and all by themselves. But they have lots of contacts, and these contacts always are making contact with them, and they're given money and so on, and they're never left alone, and they're never left on their own. Their controllers always telling them things and also helping them with things, and they're always looking out for them. They're looking out for them because these people are important to them and valuable. So you're part of a big network, and you have a lot of associates, some of whom are on your wavelength that you kind of meet with furtively or pass messages to and so on. So it's a whole different, it's a world, but it's a world that makes sense within itself. So, well, at least these are things that have come to me, because I'm kind of learning things about it. So he contacted in Shanghai. He was given another agent to contact, and that was Max Clausen, who became a close associate of his. Clausen was a German-Soviet agent also, and he met another German-Soviet agent, Ursula Kuczynski, and an American journalist, Agnes Smedley, in China. And she was a well-known left-wing journalist who worked for the Frankfurter Zeitung also. They both worked for that newspaper, Agnes Smedley and Richard Sorge. She introduced Sorge to this Japanese man who was working in China at the time, Hatsumi Ozaki, who was a communist sympathizer too. He was with a Japanese newspaper, and Sorge managed to recruit him later into his Japanese spy ring, and he was his most important contact and associate there. And he also met, I guess he's still in Shanghai, but he also met Hanako Ishii, with whom he became romantically involved at some point. That was a female Japanese woman. So he established himself as an expert on Chinese agriculture, and he traveled around the country. And he became a respected journalist who had a lot of expertise in the area that he focused on. And he was respected by a lot of people, but he was also contacting members of the Chinese Communist Party while he was there, and probably, in a sense, building a network there. But then in 1932, thinking that that's where he would be staying, but in 1932 he reported on some fighting between the Chinese and the Japanese in Shanghai. And then in December of that year, the end of the year, he was recalled to Moscow, and he wrote a book about Chinese agriculture while he was in Moscow. I mean, he could do that, you see. He became so well-versed in his subjects, and that was a great cover for him, because he didn't appear to be just a newspaper man, but he was an expert who had a reason for being respected and writing about what he's writing about and so on, and for traveling around and meeting people. And so here's where he married his second wife, Katya. She was a Russian woman, but who he met in China. And when he went back to Russia, to Moscow, he took her with him. And she stayed there, although he didn't always stay there. Now it's May 1933, and Hitler is now in power. And the GRU decides that Sorge has to organize an intelligence network in Japan. They've changed their mind now about China because of Hitler coming into power, and Hitler's making alliances with, or trying to, or thinking about it, alliances with Japan, or Japan is trying to make alliances with Hitler. And so now they're worried about Japan. So they give him the code name Ramsey. Now he gets that. He's known for having that as his code name. Sorge is Ramsay, Ramsey. And they send him back to Germany. He goes to Berlin to renew his contacts there and obtain a new newspaper assignment in Japan as a cover, because his old assignment in China doesn't work anymore. Now, see, this is where I just don't understand why more attention wasn't paid to him. But in any case, there's nobody answers these questions in anything that I've looked at. So he insinuated himself at this time into the Nazi ranks. He read all the Nazi propaganda, and in particular Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. And he attended, he said, so many beer hall meetings with his new acquaintances that he made, you know, that he had to give up drinking lest his tongue be loosened by alcohol. This was temporary, though. Now, here comes in that he had become a heavy drinker, or a regular drinker, and there's, I suppose, plenty of drinking, at least a certain amount, amongst these National Socialist activists that he had made himself friends with. And nobody suspected anything about him. He was so good, I would say, at playing his role. He really could put himself into it. And he didn't seem to make mistakes in his speech and what he said and so on. But people, you know, one thing you could say is that these people would be happy to have these new fellows show up who are National Socialists and gung-ho and join the party and all that. They're not critical. I don't think anybody was very critical of anybody else. And so they just accepted everything at face value. And he said later that giving up drinking at this time, while he was trying to get himself worked in with the National Socialists, that was the hardest thing, the bravest thing he ever did. And he said later that he would never be able to drink enough to make up for this time. I thought that was an odd thing to say, but I've learned that he really was a serious, serious drinker. And he drank daily, and he drank a lot, and how he continued to function as well as he did. But it did, in the end, I think, have a lot to do with his being caught, being the kind of whatever kind of cumulative effects all that drinking had on him. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm at the moving into the second hour of the show, and I'm not going to take a break. So we'll just keep going. I don't want this show to go over 2 hours, but it might go a little under 2 hours. That's okay if it's under 2 hours. And it's also okay, I guess, if it has to go over 2 hours. But I'm just going to keep going so that I can finish with this. And I don't want to break my train of thought here. I'm getting going here. So this drinking thing is a real big thing with him. But later, okay. So then he goes to, he's all prepared that he's now a well-known Nazi, and he's got this job with the newspaper, and he is sent to Japan. By his newspaper, he arrives on September 6, 1933. He was warned not to have contact with the underground Japanese Communist Party or with anybody in the Soviet embassy in Tokyo. He's supposed to play the role of the super right-wing National Socialist and German. And his intelligence network in Japan included a Red Army officer and radio operator, Max Clausen. Now, I don't know if Max Clausen he was a Russian. I don't know why he has a name like Clausen. I keep thinking he's German. I don't know what he actually is, but in the end, he went back to, he wasn't executed, and he went back to the Soviet Union to live after the war, well, we'll have to see when we get there, because I've already forgotten the exact details of that. but he built up this network that included this Max Clausen and Hatsumi Ozaki, the Japanese guy, and two other Comintern agents who were there in Japan, Branko Vukelic, who was somebody from Yugoslavia, who was working for a French magazine, and Japanese journalist Miyagi Yotoku, who was known as Miyagi, who was employed by the English language newspaper, the Japan Advertiser. And Max Clausen's wife, Anna, acted as ring courier from time to time. So those are the most important people in his network, but his network, there's never any names given, but it was quite a bit more people than that. But they weren't the key people. So between 1933 and 1934, he formed this network of informants. He had a bunch of informants here and there. And he did all this himself. See, this is another thing he was supposedly quite good at. He was good at organizing people and setting all this stuff up and doing it in a way that nobody found out about it. And his agents that he managed to yet had contacts with senior politicians and picked up information on Japanese foreign policy from these politicians. And Ozaki developed a close contact with the Prime Minister of Japan, Kono, and he was able to copy secret documents for Soga, secret Japanese documents. And Sorga, the most important thing that he did in Japan was to become friends and welcome at the German embassy. That became his headquarters. And they apparently believed that he was an ardent Nazi, and he was welcome there. He actually then made best friends with the ambassador. But in 1941, well, let me see. I got some things I got to skip ahead a little bit here. Let's see. He was, some of the things he did. By the end of 1933, he contributed an essay to an intellectually respected German journal, which was well received. And this raised his standing with the diplomats, the German diplomats. And he was, this helped to make him welcome in the German embassy. Also, when he joined the National Socialist Party, it was on October 1st, 1934. He didn't join, he wasn't admitted to the party until then. He probably, I don't know when he put in his application, but he was number 2,751,466. And there was a routine background check was carried out, but didn't arouse any suspicion. I don't know. You know, I keep finding this kind of strange, but maybe he had some way of kind of erasing his earlier stuff and nobody talked about it, and he was able to kind of blot it out so that there weren't any signs of it. There wasn't anybody to say, oh, yeah, I knew him back then, he was doing this. Or maybe it was just that in the National Socialist Party, their thing was to bring in the leftists, and a lot of members had been leftists in the past, and they switched over. So that was why he wasn't suspicious, because they just saw him as, well, after the war, he was working among the leftists, but now he's come over to become National Socialist, seeing the light. So that's probably the main reason. Okay, so his friendship in the German embassy was really what got him the information that was far the most important. Not all the other information. That was kind of okay, you know, this and that and the other thing, but this stuff that he got through being, he even got an office in the embassy. He even got to have an office of his own in the German embassy because they considered him such a German friend, you know, such a friend from Germany, working there in Japan alongside with them in, you know, following the same interests. And so it was in 1941 there that he learned about Operation Barbarossa and was able to pass that information on. But before we go into that, let's see. He was, I might have this out of order, but he advised the Red Army on September 14th, 1941. See, I'm kind of jumping ahead here. I wonder if there's something else that I've got that I need to... go into. No, I guess not. Most of it is going to be from memory. I think I'm supposed to remember what I was reading today. And it was that, for one thing was this accident that he had in 1938. He had started really drinking a lot, and he was... What happened in 1938 that discouraged him? Something. Hmm. In 1938, he was involved in a motorcycle accident that left him with scars and a distorted face that has been described as a Japanese mask of almost demoniacal expression. Well, I read about that motorcycle accident as it was written in one of the books about him. And he had just spent the whole evening drinking with somebody else, and then they parted in the early hours of the morning, and he had been on he was in the habit of riding a motorcycle around Tokyo, and he was in Tokyo now, and he got on his motorcycle, and his friend told him not to walk home or take a cab or something, not to drive that motorcycle home, but he did it. He got on his motorcycle and he went speeding along, and then I don't know why he was going where he was going, but he ran into a stone wall is what he did, and just smashed himself into this stone wall and knocked all his teeth out and tore his face up. But from the pictures that we see of him, I can't quite tell which ones are after 1938, because he has here's another thing. He has that oriental kind of look to his face, even when he's a young man, probably because of his Russian mother, a kind of just a different kind of a look than German. And then it becomes accentuated later. And I don't know, but he was in the hospital with his face all wrapped up in bandages and his jaw wired shut. And at that time, his little Japanese mistress was living with him. And she always lived with him after the time that they met. And I don't know, I forget now when he got there, not in 36, I think. And then he met her, and she lived with him the whole time until he was arrested. That wasn't really all that long. And then she didn't even know about it for a while. When she found out, she came to the hospital and wanted to stay there with him, but they wouldn't let her. But she was totally devoted to him, very, very sweet. And all kinds of important people came to visit him in the hospital right away. And one of them was the German ambassador, Eugene Ott. O-T-T. He had become such good friends with this Ott, and they became good friends before Ott was named ambassador. I'm not sure about that. That's what it seemed to me. But a little bit before. And then Ott just continued to think so highly of Richard Sorge, and they spent a lot of time together. And Ott shared with Sorge all kinds of information that he got in his capacity as ambassador about the war. This was after 1939. But at this time in 1938, they were already friends, and Ott came to visit him at the hospital. And then all kinds of other high-level embassy people came to see him and wish him well. And he was in the hospital for quite a while. And he had to have all this plastic surgery done later. But it was an American hospital in Tokyo, the only one. And they say it was a better hospital for that reason. And so he got good care. And then Ott's wife came to visit him quite often. Ott's wife had a thing for him, Ambassador Ott's wife. And Ambassador Ott kind of looked the other way for that, too. I don't know that they ever had anything going on, but she was quite fond of Richard Sorge. And everybody was fond. Everybody liked him. He had a big personality, and he was a clever conversationalist. And he obviously, though, never gave anything away, despite all the drinking. Now, there's a story here of when he was in this motorcycle accident that as badly injured as he was, and he was, it was discovered, you know, he was discovered real quick, and then medical help came and ambulance and so on. But he, his friend Max Clausen said that he managed to say, despite the fact that his mouth was bleeding and he could barely speak, he managed to say to somebody, get Max here. And get Max Clausen, contact him and tell him to come. And so somebody did, and Max got up in the middle of the night and got dressed and rushed off to the hospital or to the scene of the accident. I'm not sure which now. And when he got there, Sorga gave him something that he had on his person. Some kind of, you know, secret messages that were going to be sent to the Soviet Union. I forget what it was. I don't think I have it written down here, but it had some names to it. And he passed that on to Max Clausen, who took it and then took him home and did what was necessary with him. And Max Clausen said he was so impressed by that Sorge, in the midst of that terrible accident, had the presence of mind, to remain conscious until he got there. And he said as soon as he handed that stuff over to Max, Sorge lost consciousness. But he wouldn't allow himself to lose consciousness until he handed that over. And that is the kind of person that he was, when he was always thinking about his job, and of course not getting caught. So there's that. Now let's see. All right. So this thing about the German embassy, it was like a lot of people were talking to him. Another one was Erwin Scholl. Erwin Scholl, where is he at? Erwin Scholl was also friends with Sorge, and he had some position. Where is it? He was also giving Sorge a lot of information, just thinking that they were talking about these things. And discussing them, and discussing what would be best to do, and so on. And so Sorge was just such a loyal German, and one of them, and they could do that. Erwin Scholl was a lieutenant colonel. He was the deputy military attaché at the German embassy. Let's see what it says about him. He's the one. Okay. Sorry about this, ladies and gentlemen. Erwin Scholl is the one who gave Sorge the date of the 20th of June for the invasion of the Soviet Union, the Barbarossa. And it was only 2 days off, 2 days earlier than what it actually was. But before this, Sorge had been able to give Moscow information on a couple of other moves. Maybe they were the ones that came after. Well, I can't find them here. And he passed everything on to Moscow, and Stalin never acted on these things. They started not having confidence in Sorge, thinking that he was he might be a double agent or something, and he was not really giving them the real dope. So Sarge passed this information on, as is well known. Stalin, his controllers who received it, put red lines around it, didn't quite believe it, like put question marks, like how he, you know, what's this? We're supposed to now believe that we're going to be invaded on June 20th? And Stalin thought it was just baloney. He didn't listen to it. And it turned out to be true. So after that, they took him more seriously. And when he sent the information that the Japanese were not going to, had decided that they would not attack the Soviet Union from the east when the Germans were trying to conquer Moscow, they believed him then, and they acted on it, and that is the main thing that he is known for having accomplished, which is pretty major. He told the Red Army on September. He sent information to the Red Army on September 14, 1941, that Japan would not attack the Soviet Union until, one, Moscow was captured, or the Kwantung Army was three times the size of the Soviet Far Eastern forces, or, three, a civil war had started in Siberia. And this information, of course, made possible the transfer of all those Soviet divisions from the Far East to into the West, which allowed the Soviets to defend Moscow. And that, and along with the weather, was the first turning point for the Germans, the stopping point for the Germans that then seemed to, they never seemed to fully recover from that. Because by then the Russians had done their regrouping and had were continually strengthening. But all the other things that he passed on, which weren't accepted, is kind of amazing, and it's lucky, you know. So that just goes to show that no matter what somebody has going for them, like they had this Sorge, who was an amazing spy that they didn't fully appreciate early on. They had that going for them, but they didn't make use of it. So all these leaders make mistakes. And later, it's considered that later, after Sorge was discovered, and he was forced to confess, or he confessed, and then he was found guilty of treason and was sentenced to be executed. Then they tried to, the Japanese made three overtures to the Soviet Union to trade Sorge for one of their spies that the Soviets had, and they would never do it. They always answered, this Richard Sorge is not one of ours. They denied that he was working for them. And Sorge was sure that he would not be put to death because he knew this. The way they traded spies between one another, and he thought he would be traded by the Soviet Union and taken back to the Soviet Union, but they didn't go along with it. And it said that the reason is because Stalin didn't want to publicize that Sorge had discovered the date of the Barbarossa invasion and sent it to him, and he ignored it. That made him look almost like a traitor, made him look so bad that he let Sorge suffer for it. And so Sorge was executed and hung by the Japanese in 1944. Well, we'll get to that, and I have something to say about that. So let's see if there's anything I've left out here. As we move along, that's missing. You know that Something happened in 1939, but I can't, it's probably stuck some odd place. So I'll just say that we went through this, went through Irwin Shoal, and went through all of his hard work and energy, and it mentions in here that, you know, you think about all these good spies that the Soviet Union had, and they did have very good agents, and they did a good job with their agents, too, and keeping up with them and so on. But the Germans had agents, too, and one of them that is considered or has been called Sorge's rival, an opponent in Japan, was a German German agent operating in Japan, whose name was Ivar Lissner. He worked for the German Abwehr, and he was a Baltic German of Jewish ancestry. And because of that, he had trouble. His family had a lot of trouble with the SS when that was discovered. But he was a very intelligent guy and highly educated, and somehow he got recruited by the Abwehr, and he was doing some good work for Germany. And then he had a PhD in everything in foreign trade law. But I don't really have anything more. I didn't find out anything about what kind of work he did, but he was an agent of the Germans in Japan. And he continued, although the SS went after his father, and then his father was allowed to stay somewhere. And then then later on they went after him again. And they even questioned this listener. So then he didn't do as much. But later he went back to work again. So, but he seemed to have been solid. See, now there you go. So you don't know. You think, well, I was saying in the beginning, well, if somebody is not fully German, if they're part something else, then you can be suspicious that they're not going to be fully loyal. But then you can have someone like this listener who had Jewish ancestry, and he was a Baltic German, and yet didn't see anything that they found anything wrong with him ever. He seemed to be willing to help Germany and did a good job with it. So you really can't go. I'd like to find something you can go by. I'll take care of that in the summing up. Let me go to Sorge's arrest and how they did that in his trial. And in 1938, this is the motorcycle accident, yeah. And then he continued with all of his spying activities. But he was surprised and depressed when Stalin ignored so many of his analyses that he was sending. And his analyses turned out to be absolutely right. And that is, again, probably why Stalin wouldn't allow him. It was probably Stalin behind. They wouldn't allow him to be traded and come back to the United States, to the Soviet Union as one of their heroes, you know, as a former spy, because too much of his story would come out and he might even talk about it. So they just wanted to, they didn't want to bring any of that up, because he was the one who came up with the best information of all. And the only one that was ever acted on was the one about the Japanese not going to be invading the Soviet Union and helping out the, you know. Now, another thing about Sorge that I haven't mentioned, which I might come upon here, but was that he was depressed. That was what I was thinking of in 1939. He was really upset about the non-aggression pact. Here it is. I just came upon it. Signed between Germany and the Soviet Union, Germany and Stalin. He couldn't understand that because he really did believe in the myths and the stories about, you know, the glory of the communists, the people's you know, republic or whatever it was. And when they signed that non-aggression pact in 1939, he was really upset over it, and he sank into a depression. And it's even said that he was crying inconsolably for hours on end. Now that was, I don't know, because, you know, I just read that, but if you are depressed, that's what you do, you cry. You can't keep from crying if you're really in a real clinical depression. But I guess he got over that too, but I think he was had a low-level depression after that, possibly, because it got worse when they wouldn't listen to his suggestions. And and he even told the Soviet Union that the United States was going to be Japan's next target. And he wrote a lengthy memo to Moscow describing the Japanese Navy preparations. And he believed that that the attack would be in early December 1941. He was very good at analyzing these things. And he not only did it by himself, he worked with his people, with Max Clausen and this the Japanese partner that he had, and several of them, and they would get together and talk these things out and try to figure out what this information that they were all gathering meant. And they, when they felt that they had it right, and one thing that that was characteristic of Sorge is that he was really wanted to get it right, and he didn't just pass on what he heard or something, but they worked it out themselves and tried to figure it all out. And when he thought that he had it figured out and it was really good, then he sent it, and he expected or hoped that they would Stalin would act on it, but the Red Army would act on it, but they didn't always do so, and it discouraged him quite a bit. So now, as far as the level of the kind of radio messages they had, they were enciphered with unbreakable one-time pads, which were always used by Soviet intelligence agencies, it says. And so anybody who got hold of one, it just appeared as gibberish. However, due to the increasing number of these mystery messages that the Japanese were picking up, which were gibberish, that itself led them to suspect that an intelligence ring was operating, and they started intercepting these messages. The secret police did, and they began to close in. And it started, it began in September 28, 1941. So here we're just at the 3 months into Operation Barbarossa, into the attack on the Soviet Union, which, by the way, also, when that happened, when it was announced that Hitler had invaded the Soviet Union, Sorge's reaction was to go to the Imperial Bar, which was his favorite hangout in Tokyo, and start drinking. And he drank so much for hours, and then he started yelling and calling out. And he's reported as saying, "Hitler is a murderer." He's and he used some profanity. And then he called the ambassador at the German embassy drunk, and he yelled out, "They're going to lose this war." So he was blowing his cover as being a devoted Nazi, but at the same time nobody paid much attention to it because he was drunk. And even Ott, didn't let it go because he was so fond of Sarga. And this is, I don't, you know, I like to make blanket statements. And so I say, well, this is a problem with Germans. They're just so, they're so trusting and so gullible. And, you know, and this, of course, this Ambassador Ott had no business confiding all this stuff that he did with this journalist, Richard Sarga. And turned out he was a, you know, he was a spy for the enemy. But there he was doing that without asking, you know, any questions. And when the information started coming about Sarga, he wouldn't believe it. He wouldn't believe it for the longest time. So this guy, and then this guy went on, they took him out of the German embassy in Tokyo, but they sent him to China after that, and he remained in China till the end of the war, in some kind of position. I'm not sure what, but I don't know. I think he should have been reprimanded seriously for passing on all this information and running an embassy where there was so much loose talking going on. So that's my opinion, not based on very much information except just the basic information I've got here. But anyway, on September 28, 1941, secret police, the Kempetai, or however it's pronounced, arrested an elderly seamstress and asked her about people she rented rooms to. And from that, she identified Miyagi as someone who was associated with Sarga, which they figured was one of his spies or something. And so they then arrested Miyagi, who was one of Sarga's associates. And from there, you know, they found out information from him, and from there they went through more arrests and until everybody was identified. And Max Clausen was his right-hand man in Tokyo, but also this Ozaki was, and Ozaki is considered the more important ally that he had there, a Japanese man, and he was arrested on October 14th, 1941, and immediately interrogated. And they all tried to hold out. They tried to hold out, but they couldn't hold out. And Sarga was arrested on October 18th in Tokyo. And here's the thing. I don't think I think I was just reading about this today. But they knew. They knew when Miyagi didn't show up. Say Miyagi was arrested when it was. Well, right, sometime after September 28th, this woman identified him, and they went and arrested him. And so they were interrogating him and for days, you know, and he didn't show up for a meeting. And they didn't know why, but they had ways of coming into contact at certain times, you know, that were arranged, but they didn't just call each other or go see each other, things like that. So they didn't know why he didn't show up, but they were just waiting. He said, well, he might be sick, and he and Clausen were discussing it, and the other guy, Ozaki, they were discussing it and saying what to do. They were a little bit worried, but not too much. And now maybe he's sick or maybe something, he had to go somewhere. And we'll wait and see if he shows up to the next time. And, I don't think they knew that Ozaki was arrested, but Sarga and Clausen then knew that something was going on. They may have found that out, but he may have also disappeared. They may not know he was arrested, but they knew that he didn't show up either at a later time. And so now they were discussing, and they knew, they felt it. They knew that something was up. And they talked about what they should do about it, you know, that they should get rid of this incriminating evidence, and they should send these messages off that still hadn't been sent off to Russia, but they should do that. And yet, neither one of them did anything. It's funny. They went to their separate homes and they looked at the stuff, and then they decided to wait a little bit. And the next thing was Max Clausen was arrested, and then they were watching Sorge's house for a few days, and he kind of knew, but he again was like had no will left. He couldn't act. I think it's been blamed on his drinking. It's been blamed on several things, his depression, that he just wasn't himself, and he had kind of given up. But it seems like he just couldn't do anything to save himself. And he could have done it, you know. He could have done a lot, and he could have tried to sneak out of the country. But he just kept waiting to see what would happen instead of acting. And then it was too late. He denied, and he kept insisting he was a real Nazi and he wasn't a communist. And then they told him in interrogation that others had confessed and implicated him, and they knew it was, and they wanted him to confess. They knew he was, and he kept denying it. Now the thing about torture is, there's no proof about any torture. They say it probably could have been deprived of sleep. Now, I would think right away, these Japanese, God, these Asians, you know, I'm sure they went for torture right away. But they may not do that quite that quickly. Although supposedly there are some reports that they used beatings. But I just imagine they probably did use torture, but there's no clear evidence of it. And there's a lot of other things, the way you can torture somebody, like not allowing them to sleep and, you know, keeping yelling at them and asking them questions and lights on and all this stuff until they finally break down. But I think they all held out pretty well, but they finally gave up. And they got their confessions. So after that, they kept it quiet in Japan. They didn't want the public, they didn't tell the public about it, and people didn't know about it. But this thing with Ambassador Ott, he didn't say anything to anybody. He didn't communicate with Berlin about it until he sent a cable on October 23rd. He was told that Sorge had confessed, and he didn't believe Sorge was a spy, and he thought that the Japanese were screwing up, and as they so often did, he said, and that they had made a huge mistake, and he was furious, and he went and said things to him and went down there and all, but eventually he reported it to Berlin. Took him quite a few days, see. And I read that he knew his career was finished if Sorge was really a Soviet spy, because he had shared so much sensitive information with him. And a lot of people could say that. A lot of people in the embassy knew about that, what good friends they were. I mean, like buddies, you know. And so therefore, that's where he would have gotten that information that he had. So this was bad for Ott, but he also believed in Sorge, and he really truly liked him. As a matter of fact, his wife, I already told you about how his wife liked him. I don't know what went on there, but they probably had a few episodes together. But it just seemed like this Ott was a strange guy who just couldn't take these things seriously or didn't want to believe things. So when they had their last meeting, after Sorge had confessed and Ott had finally kind of accepted it, he insisted on having a meeting with Sorge in order to hear it from Sorge himself. And so Sorge was brought in to into some room to where he was, and he said it was traumatic, and he asked Sorge three questions: if he was okay, if he had enough, if he needed anything. And Sorge said no, he was fine, he didn't need anything. And Sorge was ill at ease, and they thought that he was he hated to face this man because he had fooled him, and he had pretended he was a great friend, and he had gotten all this information from him and passed it on to the enemy, to Germany's enemy. And he had to stand there. And then after that, he said to Ott, "This is our last farewell, Mr. Ambassador." And when he said that, then Ott realized that that was a confession of guilt, knowing that, you know, he was saying they wouldn't be, there's no reason for him to see him anymore. And his face kind of fell. And anyway, I really blame that man, that Ott, as much as anybody else. And let's see, there's something here by Prong. Prong is one of the people who wrote a book about Sorge. And in his analysis, he says that Sorge was entirely trusted by Ott and was allowed access to top secret cables from Berlin in the embassy. Can you imagine? And that this trust, well, I say that this trust was the main foundation for Sorge's success as Red Army spy. If this Ambassador Ott had not been such a dope and had not put his friendship, I don't know, made his friendship with this man so important, Sorge wouldn't have had that information. If he hadn't been thought so highly of in the German embassy, if he hadn't been trusted and talked to and treated by those diplomats there like he was just one of the group there, one of the Germans who were, you know, in all this, we're all in this together kind of a thing, he wouldn't have had all that information, because he didn't get it from his Japanese contacts or any of these other guys that I've mentioned here. He got it directly from the German embassy. So it's his managing to make those kind of connections in that embassy that caused all that damaging information, which probably without Richard Sorge, the whole course of the war might have gone differently. If there wouldn't maybe have been other traitors, though. But there you go. That's an example of what Ernst Zundel was saying, is that treason plays a huge part in the winning and losing of wars, more than these battles, because these battles are carried out in vain when the other side knows what you're going to be doing, or and so on. And Hitler's made those comments too, that all the bravery of the soldiers and so on is all made nothing by these traitors who pass on this information. So now, what have I got here? Some older stuff here that I added. Well, so after his confession, Sorge spent the next 3 years in Tokyo's Sugamo prison. That's when they were, he had been convicted and he was sentenced to death, but then they were working on the trade with the other, for Japanese spies, which never did work. And, you know, they don't always carry these things out right away. So they waited until November 7th, 1944. So he was in prison for 3 years, and that couldn't have been any fun at all for a man like him. He did some writing, and I don't know, not all that much, but so he suffered, And then he was hanged on November 7th, 1944 in the prison. And his friend, Hatsumu, friend and ally, Hatsumu Ozaki, was hanged earlier the same day. And the Soviet Union did not officially acknowledge Sorge as one of their spies until 1964. And just a few little facts here. His wife in Russia, Katya Maximova, was not treated well. She died a year before Sorge was hung because she had waited for him in Russia for all those years. He never returned to Russia after he was in Japan, and then he had this Japanese woman he was living with who really loved him. And the Russian wife was arrested by the NKVD in September 1942 on charges, surely false, it says, of spying for Germany. Why they arrested her for spying for Germany, I don't know. But they did, and then they sent her to a Siberian labor camp. And that's where she died a year later. So his wife didn't there. Now, that's the difference. Now, the difference is that the Japanese government, they promised that they would not harm his Sorge's mistress, Hanako Ishii, and they didn't, and they gave her a pension to live on, and they left her alone, and she was even allowed to take his at her own expense, but to gather up his human remains that had been buried in the prison graveyard and bury them in a regular cemetery with a stone and everything. That and she was just devoted to him, and she wrote a book about him called Ninjin Sorge, in which she said she did it because she wanted to show the human side of him, and she thought he was the most wonderful man that she ever knew, and he was a great humanitarian and all of that because of his belief in what he thought the communist revolution was all about, and his pacifism and so on. So I will say that, and then in 1964, the Soviet government awarded Sorge the title of Hero of the Soviet Union. They couldn't put it off any longer, I guess. And they even, they're the ones. They sent, okay, I got that wrong about the Japanese. Them giving her a pension. It was the Soviet Union who gave a pension to Hanako Ishii until she died the year 2000 in Tokyo. So once they had accepted Sorge as one of their greatest ever spies and gave him the title of Hero of the Soviet Union, they also considered that Hanako, they'd killed his other wife, but they considered that she was his wife, and so they sent her a Soviet and Russian pension in his name, I guess, to do the right thing there. Okay, that was after Stalin's time, though, so once Stalin was gone. And then I want to say that I was, in the end here, as much as I was found Sorge to be a very attractive character, like everybody seems to have done, who won people over and could make people like him, and he's make people believe in him and so on. Still, I am glad, very glad, that he didn't survive this, and that he wasn't able to be liberated and live out his life in Moscow or something, like some of the Cambridge Five were able to do, and that he had to suffer for what he did, because he was a German who, though for what he were probably legitimate reasons, you can have legitimate reasons for turning against your own country, But he did all that damage to the German war effort, which was so crucial to the way it all turned out. And so I'm glad. I am just personally feeling more satisfied that he paid a harsh penalty for that, and he didn't get away with it. So I don't have any sympathy for him, but I do recognize that he had a lot of good qualities. He wasn't a scumbag. Now, he's been praised incredibly by lots of people. Of course, that's not unusual, since these people would all be very anti-Hitler and anti-National Socialist. So since he was working against Hitler, you know, he was a good guy, but he's also considered by everybody to be the best spy of all time. Tom Clancy, the author of spy novels, said that Richard Sorge was the best spy of all time. And Kim Philby said that his work was impeccable. And Kim Philby's considered to have done very good work himself. But I think Sorge is more impressive than Kim, in considering the information that he got. But again, I emphasize that he got it because of the way that German embassy was being carried on under Ambassador Ott. If that German embassy hadn't been so loose, then he wouldn't have ever found out all that information. So another person, the chief prosecutor in the Sorge trial, who obtained the death sentence against Sorge, said, "In my whole life, I have never met anyone as great as he was." Well, I find that a strange statement, but in my whole life, I guess he hasn't. I guess, you know, he's only met a certain amount of people, being a prosecutor, and he thought that Richard Sorge was great in the sense of how much he accomplished and how good he was at it. So that's the story of Sorge, and I would like to answer the question, you know, what causes a traitor? But I do think in the last minute I have here, that whether a person is all of one nationality or a mixed nationality, I think makes a big difference in how loyal they're going to feel to that nationality in the long run, and how much they're going to feel a part of it, not alienated. So, but I can't say that really is something that you can go by. Although in his case, I think it made a difference, because he himself said that he never felt like he was quite like all the other Germans, and he always felt a little different because where he was born, and his Russian mother. Plus, he had that grandfather, Marxist grandfather, that he was so that he identified with so much. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for tonight. This has been the Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager on 7/7/14, and I will see you again on Thursday and then on Saturday. So thanks for listening, and good night.